Many marketing leaders would be thrilled to rise to the top of one heralded brand. Today's guest, Gary Briggs, has done so at over six companies. In his early days, he directed brand strategy at PepsiCo and IBM, and later, he led the marketing charge at eBay, PayPal, Google, Motorola Mobility, and Facebook, where he was the first chief marketing officer. These days, Gary sits on the boards of Etsy and Petco while serving as a senior advisor at McKinsey & Company. Gary, we are delighted to have you as our second guest on our podcast, From Startup to Scale Up. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be reconnected with you again, and I always enjoy speaking with you, so this should be fun.
Yes, I know that we're going to have a wonderful conversation. So you sit on the board of two very innovative companies, Petco and Etsy. And I'd like to start our conversation sort of at the beginning of the startup process. So what do you think? How should founders go about developing winning ideas and business models? And using some of the examples of the companies that on whose boards you have served, what are the key elements to coming up with a great idea?
Yeah, I think what I've seen in the companies I've worked with, and I've also worked in, you were kind enough to skip over two startups, one of which failed. So we can talk about that too. But, passion helps everywhere. Passion helps as a founder, as a senior executive, but it particularly helps with a consumer and a customer. Is how well can you identify that kind of passion among a group of people who are willing to, pay for your services, pay for your product? What is it about them? How do you learn about what their needs are, what their adjacent needs are, so you can actually grow a franchise around that? And I think that's one of the reasons I've always really liked marketing, is it's very much focused on understanding people and understanding those factors, those drivers as part of a business. But that's what's very true. I mean, the case of Petco is very straightforward, and it has very good competitors, but it's about the love of pets and the love of having pets in your home and caring for them. And the company, particularly in the last couple of years, has moved very much toward that, even more so than it ever has. It's gotten rid of artificial ingredients in its pet food. It's gotten rid of shock collars. It's moved much more into veterinary services and grooming services and things like that that provide a total wellness to a pet. Etsy, on the other hand, is a marketplace, and particularly one that 85% of the sellers on Etsy are women, and near all of them are small businesses. They're passionate buyers and sellers over items that have a unique point of view to them. It could be a craft, a craftsmanship. It could be a style. But that passion comes back in the seller and buyer when they connect over those items. And I think that's what I found, really was true when I was at Pepsi and working on Pepsi-Cola. And it's true when I've been working at eBay and places like that. But I think Corderwood is this passion around an idea.
Yeah. And I guess passion, understanding customers deeply, and what their needs are, so that really, because founders ought to be in the business of satisfying customer needs, eh?
Absolutely. And I do think, one of the two people I worked for when I was at Facebook was Sheryl Sandberg. Sheryl has a poster in her conference room. This is "The Future Belongs to Those Willing to Get Their Hands Dirty." And shows someone with, really dirty forearms. Chris Cox, who's my other boss, who's, still there, chief product officer, talks about it, bending the metal, that the idea that you, as regardless of your level, it doesn't matter if you're a senior executive, you need to be connected to the product, connected to the service in a way that is under the nails, feels real, is real. Because if your desire is to be in a large corporate headquarters and just live that life, stay away from startups. it is, you really have to be willing to bend the metal and understand the nature of the service and in its nuances. I mean, the beauty of it is in the nuances. It really is. I have such great memories of, you know, talking to sellers in particular when I was at eBay, who had these incredible stories of the products they were selling and the connections they had made with other people over their, you know, their specific passion. It could be, you know, antique Civil War paperweights. I mean, things like that, that are just, you know, there's people who are just into these things. And so you as a leader have to engender that, because it's a big part of what drives the success of the endeavor.
Yeah. And ultimately it comes down to finding that product market fit, doesn't it? Really making
it does. That it does. I think, you know, that phrase is certainly a factual, you know, factually accurate. And I think the only reason I always spend a little bit of time thinking about that is it strikes me sometimes as almost it's anthropological in its study. Whereas I do think that an important part of it is the experience of not just studying it, but experience it firsthand as a way to make sure you really understand what your product does well and what it doesn't.
And how do you do that, really?
Yeah, I mean, I go back to when I was first at eBay. I learned a lot from Meg Whitman, and Meg was the CEO the whole time I was there. You know, Meg said to me early on, your job, well, she said, eBay is a collection of neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and your job is to market those neighborhoods. And I thought that was a very, really insightful point about, you know, the characteristics and the relationships and the, you know, the smell, the kind of touch of a neighborhood. You know, think for yourself of like neighborhoods that you've loved or have been meaningful for you. Now, they have a character to them, and that's where the magic is, I think. So that's a big part of it. You know, we had people who worked very closely with people who were into, you know, trading cards and antiques and, you know, collectibles and cars and, you know, all sorts of things, these subcultures that you're getting to understand as far as your product and your service. And I think that's how you do it. You've got to be in it.
Yeah.
We used to say, and HR hated it, by the way, but we used to say at eBay, you had to be a seller on eBay in order to work at eBay. We would ask that question. HR said, you can't ask that question, but most people asked it anyway.
Yeah, of course. So you've gone past the idea stage and you've perhaps achieved some early traction, but that's no guarantee of success, is it?
Right.
And you have a unique marketing perspective from your time at, you know, leading and advising at all of these companies. What would you say are some of the strategies that founders need to employ to sustain early success?
Yeah, there's a very wonderful story, which will take a minute, but I think it's worth telling. About Mark Zuckerberg and my time working with him or for him and, you know, really with him. He's pretty approachable. It doesn't seem that way, but he is.
Yeah.
There was a summer intern. This is about, you know, 2015 or so. And the summer intern asked, if a Zuckerberg were a unit of measure, what would it measure? And Mark said, oh, that's a really good question. And the summer intern said, yeah, well, I was at Microsoft last summer. And I asked Steve Ballmer the same question. Steve Ballmer was the CEO at the time. And everyone was like, ooh, you know, in the audience. And it was an all hands. It was a company all hands. And a Friday all hands. And Mark said, well, what did Steve say? And the person said, oh, Steve said innovation. And people kind of laughed a little bit, which is, I think, unfair to Microsoft. But people kind of laughed a little bit about that in truth. And Mark kind of said, you know, that's unfair. And then he took a pause, which he's very known for. He took a beat and he said, willpower.
Willpower.
He said, anytime things got really hard, we just worked harder through them. And I think very much to your previous question, you know, knowing deeply about your product, knowing deeply about the consumer, those two things are central. Andy Burnt is another phrase. Andy runs the creative services for Google. He runs their internal ad agency called Creative Lab. And he was talking to me specifically in this case about product marketing, which has to do with product market fit. And he said, you've got to know the user, know the magic, and connect the two. And the magic is the feature, the function, the insight that unlocks the retention of the consumer and the passion of the consumer, to come back to that word, but the and their advocacy. And that's what drives the franchise. And when things get hard, when things get really hard for Facebook, what Mark did was he went back to those principles and dug in and really understood, you know, what is really going on underneath. I'll give you one other example. In 2006, and, you know, literally world history is different as a result, is Facebook newsfeed was introduced in, I think it's 2006. And we can talk about politics later if you care to, but this is more about startups. And in the first few days, 10% of the user base of Facebook was objecting to newsfeed. And there was a 10% not only objected, they signed a petition, and people were petitioning outside Facebook's, you know, tiny little headquarters at the time in Palo Alto, California. But what Chris talked about is the number two group within Facebook at the time that formed as newsfeed formed had to do with an organization seeking peace between the FARC and the government of Colombia in Colombia. And he realized that's really what's here, is not the initial reaction to the fact that people don't like change. It's that there's something going on here that's quite powerful, and we should understand that. And hence newsfeed stayed and newsfeed grew. But it has to do, again, with know the user, know the magic, connect the two.
Yeah. And I think that's really a powerful story, because, you know, so many founders are really focusing on their product or service, but really failing to understand what the customer actually wants in their product or service, and perhaps when they need to make adjustments, you know? And it's interesting, even with that Facebook story of recent happenings with Instagram and trying to pivot to look more like TikTok, and really the reaction from their subscribers.
Yeah, Adam Mosseri, who's the head of Instagram now, the vice president of Instagram, certainly, you know, has had a rough couple of weeks. Yeah, it's, you know, there sometimes gets thrown about, and I've worked in some of these companies with some, you know, Apple doesn't do marketing and Google doesn't do marketing, and you don't need marketing, you know, you just need product. And I got to say, that is totally urban legend and totally not true, because they are studying user behavior all the time in really deep ways. How many milliseconds does it take to load a page? Does the millisecond of the page loading in Google have an impact on the pathing of people using the product or not? You know, as an example, that is a market research, that's a data research effort, which then, oh, by the way, has a set of communications that sit on top of that, that then run the programs inside and outside the company. And this is true for Apple, it's true for Facebook, it's true for all these companies. That is marketing. It's not marketing in the sense of, I think marketing is advertising. Advertising is a component of marketing, but it's not all of marketing by far. And if anything, you know, software companies, digital companies, technology companies, the ones I've worked in really in the last 25 years, they are doing marketing all the time, very, very, very adjacent to the product or service, because it informs what drives retention, which is ultimately what unlocks the franchise value, is retention.
Yeah. And I mean, the power of data to drive decisions, I don't think founders realize enough, you know, how critical it is to gather data all the time.
Right.
That's going to help them to tweak their product or service.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to some folks this morning I think that's one of the most powerful areas of a company. I mean, I very much believe that you can have a very, very small set of employees who can disproportionately impact the franchise value, the shareholder value, the market, you know, the capitalization of a company. One of those areas is data scientists, and finding a data scientist who is not only really good at her skills and really understands, you know, how to run an A/B test that is clean, you know, understanding how to track a cohort over time is vital. And that person needs to be a good communicator. You know, we've all worked with research people who want to, the best part of their job is they don't have to deal with people. It's just such a weird thing. You know, you need someone who's a really good communicator and they can make a really huge difference in your company. I think I talk to a lot of founders who say, you know, I want a CMO, and I've been a CMO, and I very much say to them, no, you don't. You probably don't want to, at least not right away. You know, they want to go hire a CMO because they want to, they start throwing out C titles, you know, you're the CTO and you're the CMO and you're the C, you know, whatever. And it's a mistake. It's really, first of all, it's very hard to fire people with C titles. And the other is find some people who are really good at data, find some people who are really good at communicating that data. It's going to make a huge difference before you hire a CMO.
I think about the challenges that founders, particularly in the Caribbean, face because they don't have access to the capital that will allow them to have a big team around them, you know? Yeah. And what would you say to a Caribbean founder who is limited in that respect, in, you know, finding the resources, finding the people, the skills, being able to pay, you know, the salaries that some of these specialists are demanding. How should they go about addressing this issue of having, you know, the right skills around them?
I do think that's really hard. I mean, it's a related problem, maybe not the same problem in the United States, where I've talked to organizations that are in the Midwest, you know, in particular in Kentucky, that are trying to do startups, and you know, all the money and all the talent supposedly is on the coast, and it's hard to get a venture capital firm to pay attention to you when you're in Lexington, Kentucky. I think, you know, I do think, Sandra, to put a little bit back on you, I think one of the reasons I'm very interested in what you've been doing is you're trying, and your organizations you're involved with are trying to change that. And I do think it's really important sociologically to the world. I mean, I think, you know, one of the practical problems in the U.S. where I've, you know, spent most of my life is very few zip codes are benefiting from the wealth, to be blunt, and the opportunity created by technology. To take a step aside for a second, I don't think we really know what the impact has been of COVID and lockdown on mental health, on families and society for years. I would say, and I'm generally an optimist, I think one of the things it is doing is it's getting people to realize they don't need to live in one of five cities to have a great career in technology. And I do think that more geographies, more regions, more people will be able to work in technology because they're realizing that you don't have to be in a headquarters at all. So I do think the flow of people will, and we're already seeing this, the flow of people is starting to change, and the nature of jobs as people are hired is starting to change. You know, I'm hopeful for young women and men who are coming out of school, whether it be high school or college or some advanced degree, who live in the Caribbean, that they can get as easily hired by a, you know, I don't know, DoorDash or TikTok as they could be doing something else. And, you know, you can get some experience. You might be the data person who gets hired into a TikTok or some company and then learns a set of skills that you then go scratch your itch in being an entrepreneur. So I think I'm answering in two ways. I do think that trends are changing in a way that's going to benefit. I do think the organizations like what you're involved with is really important. And a little bit related to something you touched on very briefly, but we can come back and talk about, you know, being a CEO, being a founder is a bit lonely. It can be very lonely. And it's why taking time every week to talk to other people outside your company is really important, because you will find someone who is facing a similar problem to yours. You may not at all, but you know, 3 months later, you realize, gosh, you know, I should go back and talk to Sandra, because she can really help me here.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's so true, Gary, especially with Revo. You know, I found that the community of founders, just by being together, I mean, even this new cohort that we have, I've seen them starting to organize their own little sub-meetings to discuss issues, to share resources, to share contacts with people. And I think that, for me, that's the key, you know, really to tap into a community of people who are facing very much the same issues as we are. And, you know, really focus less on the fact that you don't have a lot of money to pay a lot of people, but really lean on. I mean, even having you with us, we had Michael Lee Chin as our first podcast guest. And the learnings from just, you know, talking to people and having access to them, I think is a very powerful thing.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot from that through my own work, is, you know, people who were a couple of years ahead of me who maybe experienced something, and it may not be the exact thing, it may be just somewhat adjacent to it, but it can be, provide a lot of insight.
Yeah. So I one of the things that, and it's kind of related, you know, a CEO, a founder, who really demands, you know, a huge salary just because I'm building this business that's one day going to be great. You know, how should founders sort of look at the whole business of compensation and even compensation for their teams? You know, very often, you know, you might have to offer somebody who has talent shares in your company and you know, create a bond that's going to have you working together to achieve this. How should founders look at the whole business of pay for performance?
Well, I do think it's a hugely important arena, obviously, because, you know, the thing that kills companies is cash and time. But what can severely injure a company is bad hiring, or kill it. And it's very hard. It's very costly to, fire someone. And so aligning, I think you touched on this, aligning, incentives and aligning performance and connecting that to compensation is a first principle, I think. You know, one of the things I found when I was a CEO or a general manager and hiring people is you know, people are obviously very, understandably, they're very demanding about their compensation. And they will say, you know, I did this and that. I was at Google and therefore, you know, I therefore get paid X. And I think you've got to really push back on that pretty hard. And in particular, a couple of things that I found helpful to your point of aligning incentives is, you have to have very clear objectives for the organization. You have to have them for the key functions. People need to perform against them or they don't stay. And it sounds ruthless. I don't mean it to sound that way other than it just makes, it's clarifying. And giving someone a very significant salary without connecting that to very clear objectives is not a good use of your time nor your money. And if things go south, it makes it really, really hard to have somebody leave the company. It takes a lot of time. You know, legal lawsuits can get involved if that's the case. You know, things like that. You need to make the objectives very clear. I do find that, and it depends on different countries have different laws around this, but an early period of 90 days and not having, you know, particularly having compensation or what are called kickers, you know, where you're getting a signing bonus or success fee or having your first stock vesting shouldn't happen until, you know, what I would call is often called a probationary period, where it's 90 days or 180 days to make sure that the job is a good job for you, you know, that's a good fit. And so a lot of companies do that. You know, Netflix, you can read about this online. Netflix has a lot of policies around this and will pay people to leave after 90 days if it's not a good fit or they've had, you know, second doubts about staying. But giving away points of compensation is quite expensive. The worst arguments I have had with venture capitalists have been about basis points dilution over comp. But the point in fact is that if you have a little bit to what I mentioned earlier, if you have a very, very strong performing employee, that person can have a disproportionate impact on the success of the company. And so you want to align those incentives. And then the other thing, probably one of the best sets of questions I got in a reference check was from Tony Hsi, who's the founder and CEO of DoorDash. And he asked me a lot about, it was a person who used to work for me, who's now the CMO of DoorDash, a really talented guy named Kofi. And he talked with me a lot about year two, not just the beginning. So I think the other thing to think about when you're hiring somebody is, you know, not what is the first 90-day plan, but what's this person like in year two? And make sure you really understand that so you're hiring somebody well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, just sort of, you know, moving on to once you have the people there and you really need to create some kind of culture that is going to have everybody pulling in the same direction, that, you know, you can build trust and have good communication so that you all, you know, that vision that you have expressed, that everybody is going to pull in the right direction. What are your thoughts on building a great company culture?
Well, I think, you know, you touched on a word that's really important. Communications is vital. One of the things I made sure I did in the later jobs I had, particularly when I was running large organizations, is I had someone who ran, you know, back office, actually operations for the department. And they made sure that we were having all hands. They made sure that I was sending out, you know, communications. I've always been somebody, I want to, you know, do my work and then go home. and I wasn't so much into, you know, happy hours and I think a little bit because, you know, I was in Silicon Valley in particular. By the time I got there, I was nearly 40. I'm nearly 60 now. I was in my late 30s, I guess. I think it's really important to continue to communicate to the staff and do it in a very honest way. It's a hard balance. You know, you're also in this point when you're the founder and you're the CEO. Everybody is, in fact, you know, you're being watched every day. Like, you know, how's Sandra doing today? Is she happy? Is she not happy? Does that mean that things are going well or not well? Am I going to be here, you know, a month from now, or is something going wrong? And are we going to win that big deal that we're doing or not? I mean, everyone's trying to look for signals all the time. And I think from a communication standpoint, being really honest that is a reality of what it's like to be inside a startup is really important, because it's these little anxieties that build up over time that cause people to have, you know, odd behaviors. But communication is super important, doing it in little ways and big ways, you know, all hands help, quick notes, you know, getting out of a meeting and writing a note to someone who's, you know, otherwise, you know, you don't interact with, and just say, hey, you know, Sandra, that was a really great point you made in the meeting today. I've been thinking about that and I'm going to, you know, let's talk about that next week and follow up on that. You know, those are all really important things to the communication flow. The other thing which I particularly saw at Facebook, and Mark is extraordinary about, is how fast information flows in the company. It was very delayered. Anybody on my team could be meeting with Mark at any minute, and I'd have no idea. You know, I mean, it's not like somebody three levels down needed to talk to someone two levels down to then get to me, to then get to Mark. And we reviewed the deck four times before it got to Mark. None of that. And it reminds me of the opposite. I think about this once in a while. It reminds me of the opposite experience I had. I went from Pepsi in 1997. I went to IBM to go run brand strategy for IBM. And the CMO at IBM at the time was this really talented CMO, a woman named Abby Constam. And we were having this meeting that was coming up the following week with Abby, and the whole meeting we were having, this is like my second week, was what are we going to present to Abby and what does Abby want to talk about? You know? And I said, well, have anybody just stopped by Abby's office and asked her? And everyone looked at me like I was insane. And I thought, oh, damn, I've made a career mistake. I've gone to the wrong place. if Abby only knew, you know, how much time was wasted on that stuff. So that's the other most important, is make yourself approachable, you know, for good news and bad news, because that makes information flow much better too.
Yeah. And I think, often about a company that I had invested in, and the CEO didn't like to share bad news with the board, for example. And, you know, that was just, I mean, just the worst thing he could have done. And so often I think founders think, okay, let me keep the bad news to myself. But that's really counterproductive, isn't it?
It reminds me, there's a guy I worked with when I was at eBay who has this... really early in my time there. He had been there since the, you know, early part of the founding. And he gave me these two slides that had like, here are the 10 things to not do, you know, and they were based upon things that other people had done that have gotten them fired. And I think very high on that list as a CEO is hiding bad information from the board. Just, oh my gosh. It's the worst. I remember being I was one of the first boards I was on. I won't name the company, but we had to push out the CEO, and I had brought in a former CIO of PayPal whom I work with to be on the board with me, really great guy. And he said at one point in a meeting, he said, I'm no longer surprised at being surprised in a board meeting. And that was when I was like, okay, we're going to have to replace Michael. You know, it was pretty obvious, you know.
You know, I deliver the course on corporate governance, and the founders in the class are always sort of frightened when I say to them, you know, you are the founder and CEO, but you can be fired. You know, many founders don't think that, especially if they have investors, that they can be fired. I mean, and it's so important, I think, for founders to understand that they are doing a job. And just like anybody else, if they're not performing, they can certainly lose that job. You know, Go ahead.
Oh, my second startup, I fired myself.
Okay.
I wasn't the right person to take us to the next phase. And I knew that. And I went to the chairman and I said, hey, you know, whom I'm still close with. And I said to him, I need to be replaced. And there's a different set of skills that take us from here to there. And I'm not it, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I really respect a founder who can acknowledge that they are not the one, you know, because, you know, many of them are very good with the technical aspects of the business and just really don't have the variety of skills that it takes to be a great CEO.
I mean, in my case, I don't know enough computer science to run a product management team to then manage engineering time. And that was needed. You know, someone needed to do that. And that was the key to the unlock of that company.
I want us to touch on something you and I had a talk about some time ago, the value of time, and how a founder should really use his or her time.
I think I've seen this in a couple of ways. One of the things is I do believe in calendar management and being very crisp about calendar management. Some of the most successful people I know, in the sense of not just their financial success, but their kind of life success of having, you know, balance and health and things like that, is they're very, very specific with their use of time. And I'm good at this, and I'm still learning about it, and I'm 60. But one of the things I did at nearly 60, but one of the things I learned later on was I started to schedule in 15-minute meetings. And I did that because it turned out I could do a one-on-one with someone in 15 minutes. It didn't have to be 30. It definitely didn't have to be an hour. One quick side story that's related to that is in 2010, Larry Page at Google came back to be the CEO again. Speaking of stepping aside, he was the first CEO. And then in around maybe 2000 or so, he stepped aside and Eric Schmidt famously came in as a CEO. And Larry was the head of engineering, if I remember correctly. But in 2010, when he came back in as the CEO for the second time, that weekend, he changed the default in Google Calendar invites within the company from 30 minutes to 20 minutes and from 60 minutes to 50 minutes. And of all the signals he could be sending his first days at Google, that's the signal he sent. He's like, we're too long in meetings. They don't need to be that long. People need time between meetings to call somebody or send an email or go for a walk or whatever they're going to do. And so that had to do with time. And then the other story that really resonated with me, and this is one maybe we did speak about, is Reed Hastings, who's the founder of Netflix, was on the board of Facebook when I was at Facebook, and I got to know him a little bit. And he talks about nights away or nights not at home with his family. And if you don't have a family, you know, it could be nights not working to make sure you're
mental health,
to what we talked about earlier, connecting to somebody, you know, doing something from exercise, stress relief. Right. Going and talking to somebody who has nothing to do with your thing, who, by the way, may turn out to have a lot to do with your thing, you know, later on. Just opening your mind up, freeing your mind up. But Reed's view is, I spend 10 nights away from dinner with my family. And, you know, Reed Hastings can go to lots of things, you know, anything in Hollywood, any festival, he can have dinner with lots of people. He's like, I'm focused on no more than, and so he optimizes within any month. It's like, you know, hey, you know, I can't do that thing, and I'm not going to do it because it's not one of the 10 things I'm going to do. And he doesn't apologize for it. And I think that I found that incredibly insightful. If I think about one of the things for me, I worked in marketing from 1985. And I worked in advertising most of that time. You know, I did large advertising campaigns most of the time. And this is going to be an easy ding. I went to the Cannes Advertising Festival once. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't help you to go drink, you know, Appletinis on a yacht in Cannes. It's fun, but it's not where it's at.
Yeah, and I mean... I think about even meetings, you know, and founders having meetings. At our retreat in April for the last cohort, one of the founders talked about, you know, meetings focusing on your OKRs and not even talking about the things that you're doing well, but focusing on those areas of the business that are not doing well. And so often meetings just descend into this long, you know, everybody making a point. But founders could really be so much more efficient and more focused if they were using their time, you know, sparingly in these meetings, making sure that they're focusing on the right things.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, particularly in companies I've been in, you know, the spending all the time, you know, presenting slides to each other is just, it's the worst. You know, Amazon famously, you know, makes you write it in a Word doc. Procter & Gamble, you know, back in the day was and still does that. They were early in that too. In the middle of my time working at Facebook, when we got to a certain size, you know, Mark demanded a pre-read beforehand, and most of the times he read it, and so you weren't presenting slides to each other. You went in and you had a, you know, my one-on-ones with Sheryl Sandberg, which were a half an hour. I mean, we would get done in less than 15 minutes all the time. I just, you know, I was, when I went to go meet with her, I'd go with a bulleted list of things I was doing or things she needed to know about. I might have a document I need to show her or a piece of creative I needed to show her. And I had it ready on my laptop and bam, 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 make a discussion. If she wanted something else she wanted to talk to me about, you know, had to do with Facebook, had to do something personal, whatever. Or if I did, there was extra time. Otherwise she gave the time back. And everybody's happy about it. Time management is really important, and cycle time is really important. Related to that is the best companies I've been around, part of, observed, make decisions faster and most importantly, learn faster. And all that has to do with time management. Yeah.
So Gary, we haven't really touched a lot on your particular area of expertise, which is marketing. You know, how there's so many ways now, you know, that people can connect with their customers. How do you feel about the rise of social media and you know? Is a focus just on social media the way to go? I see a lot of companies just focusing on social media.
I'm reminded of an old marketing boss of mine, which said that, you know, people want to go where there's something going on. I think digitally, look, I mean, the point is how much we're using our phones and how much we're on devices. You can talk about, there's all sorts of, you know, societal issues there. I do, as a step aside, I do think we will look back at this era and think it was insane that we were staring at black mirrors as much as we have been. You know, a huge part of what drives media is time spent and how much time people are spending in apps or on their phones, in messaging in particular, which is a huge, huge function of time spent in phones. And so that is where the conversations are happening. And your job as a marketer is to manage the conversations about your brand. And therefore, I think digital is very, you know, central to that. It's interesting, as an aside, Sandra, the amount of money spent in digital advertising as a proportion of time spent using digital products is still not one-to-one. So meaning that's still a disproportionate amount of money is spent in television, radio, and print. That's why you've seen, you know, Google, Facebook, Snap, you know, Twitter to some degree, TikTok now, which is probably one of the fastest growing apps of all time. It has to do with where people are spending time. So now, having said that, I really always bristle with the, you know, hey, go make me a viral video, or we need a TikTok, you know, because everybody else has got a TikTok. Yes, it's true that people want to go where there's something going on, but people aren't going to invite you back unless you have something to say. And that, I think, is what is the thing to really think about is, okay, so, you know, so you're going to go do an Instagram thing. Great. You know, what are you going to say? How are you going to show up? Yeah, in a way that is compelling and interesting and different than everybody else. And I would really, don't chase the tactic, you know, chase the conversation. That's the insight.
Yeah,
for me.
I love that.
Yeah,
don't chase the tactic, chase the conversation. I think that's great. I also want, you know, switching gears again, thinking of,
I love switching gears. It's good with me. It's fine, as much as you like.
Thinking about a conversation we had recently too, about, you know, having the right people around you. You know, I think there's a, certainly in my experience, people want to always be hearing positive things. They don't like to. I was talking to one of our founders today, and, you know, we're talking about what's the truth, you know, and really telling the truth. Is that something that you think is something that founders really need to be aware of and be careful about in terms of having the right people around them? People who can actually tell them the truth.
I was thinking about this the other day. I'm not going to get the quote right. There's an old movie. It's a little bit of a controversial movie now, but Patton, which is a George C. Scott movie. It's a very long, long movie. But George C. Scott is the actor, is this voiceover at the end. And I don't remember who the Roman emperor that he talks about, but he talks about the Roman emperor has just conquered some territory. And he always had a guide who whispered in his ear, all glory is fleeting. And I'm going to go back now and watch that clip, but you need people around you who are saying things like, you know, not necessarily all glory is fleeting, but this idea that just, you need to know what is truth. I say, I've gone into a lot of companies at this point where I'm not the first employee and, you know, there's lots of employees already. And all of a sudden I've inherited some large department I got to go run. My first all hands, one of the first things I say, and I do whatever I can to uphold the spirit of it, is you can say anything to me as long as it's not mean. meaning that meanness comes from a different place than honesty. Manipulation comes from a very different place than empathy. And I would say what happens in particularly larger companies as you get bigger is people disguise one as the other. And really understanding that there's people who are going to appear on their surface to be mean and they're actually very empathic. There's a writer, a guy out of Wharton, a professor named Adam Grant, who talks about giving and taking, these disagreeable givers, people who aren't necessarily going to go along with everything in the organization. They may be, you know, irascible, but they want everybody to be better. It's just that the way that they go about it is a little bit, you know, different than others. They're very valuable people to have inside of a company. It's very different than having people who are agreeable takers, who pretend that they want what's right for everybody and what they really want is what's right for themselves. And having people around you who can be honest is not only important for the organization as a founder, as a leader, it's really important to you. The best, some of the most foundational things in my career came from people who in the moment told me something I absolutely didn't want to hear, but I had to, about me. You know, about a blind spot, about a point of stubbornness for me, about, in both those cases, I was early at McKinsey and Clay Deutsch, who was a director, said, Gary, you know, you're very affable and people want to be around you,
but
you need to prove your credibility first and your personality second. I was like, oh, shit, that's really insightful. You know, that's good to know when you're 25. And then later in my life, I almost got fired from eBay and a gentleman who was a peer of mine, who became a boss of mine because I got layered. I was walking down a street with him and somebody else was being really mean to me at work. It sounds like a schoolboy thing, but maybe, you know, he was doing his best to knife me, given I had had a falling out with the CEO, which we'd end up, you know, Ms. Meg Whitman, which she ended up patching up and it all worked out fine. But it was a bad series of months. And Dana's his name. He works for a firm called Matrix. He's a venture capitalist now. Dana Stalder just said to me in the moment, because I was, you know, complaining about something, he says, you need to figure out if you're going to stop complaining or if you're going to start proving, you're going to keep complaining or you're going to prove people wrong. And I thought to myself in the moment, what an asshole. That's not what I want to hear. I want to complain. You know? And he was exactly right.
Yeah. So another thing, and I think, you know, we've had such, it's been a great conversation for me. I hope everybody thinks so too. But
we'll keep the cards and letters coming. You can tell us in the comments later.
You have talked about the importance of having a supportive life partner, you know? And I totally agree with you, because this journey of being a startup founder is just fraught with, you know, all kinds of hills and valleys. And it's really great to have somebody who can be supportive of you. You've talked about your wife, Catherine, in particular. Why is it so important for a founder to have a life partner who is there for them?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, for what it's worth, I gave a commencement speech at my old high school about this, about the nature of success and how people view success, called Two Truths and a Lie. And what it's really about, you don't have to watch the 15 minutes of it if you want to, but love is the most important thing. It just is. It's, you know, absolutely the most important thing. And I think particularly when you're in a tough environment, having someone you can confide with who knows you well enough and with everything they know about you still loves you and still will be honest with you, to what you just asked a moment about, Sandra, that, you know, we'll be able to say, hey, you know, Gary, you missed that, or you're wrong about that, or you're really right about that, and I want you to go, you know, fight for that. All that's super important. And that's a whole arena that we can talk about for, you know, for a while. But to answer your question, the other part I found about it is from a resilience standpoint. It's you know, I find I've made mistakes in my career. I've gone to go work for, you know, bad people or bad things that somehow weren't a fit for me. I've also, you know, not taken jobs that seemed attractive, but, you know, my wife was like, that doesn't seem right. And she was right. But resilience, the ability to recover from stumbling, from failing, is hugely important to a career. It's hugely important whether you're changing jobs or getting setbacks within the startup or the job you have. And a huge part of that has been Catherine for me. She's the things I've been working on in the last couple of years, which have to do more with US politics. You know, she's very much talking to me all the time about, you know, you have things to do still. You have things that are important that need to get done in the world. You know, you're going to go do those, right? You know, and it's everything. Because, you know, as you go through this this journey as it is, I've realized I'm never going to have it figured out. And that's the point. Like, I really find the people who think they have it all figured out, you know, I don't want to be around them. It's just not that interesting. And so my wife and I have always really embraced a bit of the chaos.
Yeah.
And
journey of discovery, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I hope that I will get a chance to meet Catherine later in the year.
Thank you.
We've invited you to be in person at our retreat, and I hope that we can make it happen.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so Gary, thank you so much. I want to thank you for coming on today and all the support that you have given to RevUp, and we hope that our relationship will be long and strong.
Thank you very much. It's very easy. I always enjoy, as I said at the outset, I always enjoy speaking with you, and it makes it very easy to say yes to what you ask.
Okay. All right. So thanks again.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.